This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rise for Justice Movement, the podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise for Justice Movement and the Rise for Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. And this is the very last episode of our 2025 season of the podcast. We began this podcast in August. And ever since then, I have sat down and talked to some incredible people. I talked to Jeffrey Epstein survivors, along with my co-host, Gwen. And I have to say thank you to everybody who has supported us along this way. We're going to be doing some resting during the month of December. We'll be doing some resting up throughout the new year. But we're doing some revamping. We have some more exciting interviews that are lined up, including another member of Congress. And there's some other things that are coming up. And speaking of Congress, today I am joined on the podcast by somebody that I was introduced to by one of my other co-founders and let me know about this human being that is running a very impactful campaign in the state of Florida. And without further ado, Maria Elena, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
I am so incredibly excited because you bring this energy, you bring the passion, you bring everything to running for Congress. You're the definition of what it looks like to be a leader in a space that is incredibly competitive. So again, thank you so much for allowing me to have this conversation with you, and you know, welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited, and feel free to jump in and introduce yourself to our listeners.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here, and what an honor. I admire everything your podcast does and the important topics you talk about, so thank you again for inviting me.
Absolutely. You know, I admire your campaign. Because you're running, again, you're running in Florida. And this is quite the challenge. But if there's anything about you, I know that you're always up for a challenge. And I would love for you to just give us an overview of what made you want to run for Congress and why it's important to elect those progressive candidates to get into Congress and work for the people over a corporation, over a billionaire, because the people is what really matters here. So I would love for you to run us through what led to the decision to run for office.
Absolutely. That goes back to my childhood. Is it fine if I start there? I know it's a bit of an explanation.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. And just paint like that picture. I think by now, people that are avid listeners of the podcast, they're used to the direct rambling. They're used to hearing my voice, but they're also used to listening to the guests on the podcast as well. So I think that would be very well reciprocated. And it also paints that whole picture to the human side of candidates and the reason why they are running.
Perfect. That's fantastic. So, growing up, I still am the youngest of four kids, and we were raised by a single mom. My dad passed away when I was five, but he was also extremely abusive towards my mom and towards us. She took the brunt of the abuse, both physical and mental. She had a lot of scars mentally and physically from it. She experienced traumatic brain injuries and overall just unimaginable amounts of abuse at the hands of my father. So when he passed away when we were five, my mom was left to take care of all of us while also trying to rebuild her life because it had been broken apart completely by then. And we ended up spending some time in the foster care system in Cleveland, Ohio, before my mom was able to regain custody and move us to North Carolina to be closer to family. And in the process of doing so, when we got to North Carolina, we had to rely on EBT and Medicaid, free school lunches. Basically, if there was a social program that helped single moms, my mom had to utilize it to keep us alive and give us stability in our childhood. She was fantastic. She was loving, caring, and she did everything she could to take care of us. And so, growing up on those social programs, I got to experience firsthand kind of how the government strong arms those who are the most vulnerable and can sometimes leave you behind altogether in a form of administrative strangulation, making it extremely difficult to access the benefits that you need. And in high school, as soon as I could, and for at 14 is when you can legally start working in North Carolina, I got my first job and my second job shortly after. So I had two jobs in high school. I joined the Navy at 17 during my senior year. I went to boot camp 10 days after graduating high school in order to break the cycle that I was in and achieve more opportunities that wouldn't have otherwise been available to me, as well as have a route of stability that I didn't know was possible. So I went to boot camp and I joined as a nuclear reactor plant operator on the mechanical side. And during my time in the military, I became a nuclear reactor plant supervisor on board the USS Nimitz. And then I went out to New York City and Long Island. And while I was out there, I was talking to thousands of people a week. So I was in a public-facing role as a nuclear field coordinator. And during this time, where I had these mass amounts of interactions with people, I was hearing their hopes and dreams and what they were struggling with, and getting to know them individually en masse, if you will. And during my time out there, my mom got very sick. She had had breast cancer in the previous years, and she got increasingly sick and unfortunately passed away when I was 24 years old while I was out there. And anyone who's lost somebody knows that you go through a very reflective period afterwards. So at the same time that I was reflecting on everything my mom had taught me, all the experiences we had growing up, our struggles in our childhood and her struggles into adulthood, I was seeing the same exact problems and the same exact struggles we had faced 15 years earlier, worse than ever in the face of thousands of Americans that I was speaking to a week. And that's when I determined that nothing was going to change. It was going to keep getting worse. The government would keep leaving us, the working class, further and further behind. And no one was coming to save us. No one was coming to do anything. And we have to do it ourselves. And I had long conversations with my leadership, and I determined when I departed from my military service is when I would step into public service to try to continue to make a difference in any way that I could.
Oh my gosh, speaking of technical difficulties, I was hitting the unmute button, and anybody who knows Zoom, you will know that oftentimes Zoom likes to glitch a little bit, and it was not letting me unmute until I hit it a certain way. So, apologies to anybody who is listening. They're probably like, Zach, hello, welcome back to the podcast. That is not the first time that this has happened.
It's a
But
nice
anyway,
dramatic pause.
yes. It's very, 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 very. And if there's anything about me, it's very dramatic. But You know, thank you for sharing a bit about your backstory and
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
The reason to, run for Congress and make that change and be the voice that a lot of people don't really have in their representatives, right? And I think it's important to elect people who are relatable to the people that are in their communities. And I think that's incredibly powerful. So, again, thank you for your service, first of all, and thank you for also sharing a bit about your story. Now, let's kind of dive in a little bit and talk a bit about your platform and what matters the most to you in regards to community organizing, but also being a representative of the people and being a representative of, your values, but also listening to what your community needs. What's been the response since you announced your campaign? What are you hearing? What are you seeing? And what have you been doing?
Luckily, the community has been extraordinarily supportive. And in large part, I would say it's because my campaign and what I'm doing is based in principle. It's activism first. I always like to say I'm an activist first and foremost. I am out here every day fighting for our communities through advocacy work, food drives, clothing drives, things to uplift our working class community now, not in 2 years after the fact. And I know for a fact from what people are saying, they're tired of the empty promises of saying, I will do something after I'm elected, or I will do something after I'm reelected, instead of doing it now. If they were running principled campaigns, they could take action during, and that's the way we need to be running politics in general. There is a better way to do it. It's not just asking for money and making empty promises or promises that will be delivered once upon a time. It's about doing it today and taking those actions every step of the way to uplift the community. Because as you build a campaign, you build a platform, and even if it's small, it gives you the ability to do something and to take action and to get involved through mutual aid in the community. And so that's what I'm striving to do because I'm a firm believer that politics without principle and without action is only performative. It's empty. They're doing it to gain clout or to gain a following or to gain a position in office and use it as a career stepping stool, which isn't what it's for. It's to fight for our representatives in the community to make changes and take their voice with us into office and then relay the things back to them, have open lines of communication both ways. It shouldn't be you're waiting months to talk to your representative. They're never available. You don't know what they're doing. You don't know where they are. And that's what we're seeing. And the community has been extremely supportive because I'm introducing that new way into Central Florida. It exists in other parts of the nation. I'm just trying to bring it down here because we deserve it too. So everyone is very supportive. Some of the biggest concerns that I'm seeing and hearing in our community are the cost of living. I think that's a universal one, but it's hitting especially hard in Central Florida. Some of the largest purchasers of homes and land are developers, and those developers in the process of buying everyone out of the ability to own land, or they're hiking up the cost of living here, hiking up the cost of property value, making it so that people have no chance at living independently without renting for the rest of their lives, or having predatory interest rates. And they're also developing these lands that are then causing flooding in the surrounding areas of people who do own homes here, who people who rent, causing a bunch of property damage, and that's all encycled into the cost of living. And with the recent attack on our healthcare insurance, healthcare availability, people are being priced out of having medical care as well right now. People are seeing their insurance premiums triple, go up to $3,000 from $700, and they're having to choose between being able to buy food and pay bills and having medical insurance at all. So those are some of the biggest issues that we're seeing out here and hearing about.
Speaking of issues, looking at your platform on kinterforcongress.com/values-beliefs. I made that sound like it was like a whole, like, all right, sorry, y'all. It's the end of the podcast and I like to be a little goofy, but let's get down and talk a little bit. So transparency and trust, this is something that a lot of people do not have in their elected officials. And there's one thing, or there's a couple things like specifically out of this specific part. And your stance on this is, quote, "Our democracy cannot function when the voices of citizens are drowned out by big money and special interests. Restoring trust requires fundamental reforms to ensure accountability, transparency, and a government truly representative of the people." Now, at the very beginning of whenever it states, "My solution, overturn Citizens United." This is probably my favorite thing on your platform, if I'm being fully honest. Like, there's a lot of things that we'll, you know, do some more diving into this, but overturning Citizens United, that constitutional amendment to overturn the disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision and get big money out of politics. Let's hit on this for a second. Why is it important to overturn Citizens United and get the big money out of politics? Because whenever I think about this, I think about those super PACs and I think about some of the other PAC money, specifically a PAC that is infiltrating Congress.
Absolutely. It is extremely important to overturn Citizens United. As you said, it was disastrous. And to be frank, both parties are guilty of it and both parties need reform on it. This isn't just a one-sided partisan issue. Both parties need to be reformed in their campaign finance. And the reason is because we will never have any progress, politically speaking, or in terms of equality, until the political narrative is not controlled by special interests, foreign interest, or corporate interest groups. It will never be reflective of a government for the people and by the people if the people who are controlling the conversation have an agenda that they're paying to be pushed for. We won't have progress.
Exactly. And we're stuck in this trickle down economic capitalistic hellscape that there's one thing that I think of whenever I think about corruption, I think about the healthcare system. And I think about this, and I know on your platform, you know, moving into the next part is the cost of living, because the rent is too damn high. And, you know, like you said, whenever you have these corporations come in, and specifically here in Kansas, we have Airbnb that likes to go in and they'll buy, you know, like rental properties, and they yank the price up, and then they also give you like these short-term contracts of living, and then after that contract is done, you're out. Like, what exactly is that doing? That is contributing to the ongoing problem. And then the county in which I live just literally passed an ordinance to criminalize people that are unhoused and people that are living on the streets, or they're living, you know, under the bridges, and they're going to arrest them and throw them directly in jail. What exactly is that doing? That is contributing to people being automatically thrown into a system that they do not need to be in. And I think about our veteran community. It's something that I hit really hard on because my grandfather was a veteran. My mom has it distilled in my head to directly focus on veterans because they risk their lives. They go overseas, they go to war, they do, you know, anything during their service. They come back and oftentimes they're left with absolutely nothing. And that is the reality of that, because I grew up in the culture of war. We're still in this culture of war. Look what's happening in Gaza. Look what's happening in Congo, Sudan, and across the world. Look what is happening. We're still at war in Ukraine. And it's just so devastating thinking about bringing a child into this world right now. Like, I can't even begin to fathom like how I feel, let alone how my friends feel. it's a very dark moment in our country and across the world. It's a very dark moment. So I think with your campaign shining a light on these issues, I think it does begin to raise some questions. And it also generates those conversations. And anyway, diving in and talking about workers' rights. So we know there's a lot of places do not have paid family leave. They don't have paid leave. They're dealing with wage theft. You know, workplace safety is off the rockers. It's not very safe for workers. And then the right to organize is also, and the right to unionize, I would also add into this directly. It's under attack right now. So let's talk about the PRO Act and what exactly the PRO Act would do to make it easier for workers to form unions and collectively bargain for better wages, benefits, and working conditions. Why is it important to pass the PRO Act?
It's important to pass the PRO Act for a variety of reasons, but mostly and foremost because the people who are building the economy, the workers who are shaping and giving our economy the ability to be successful, deserve a protected workplace. They deserve to have the protection to have a collective voice to bargain for safe, fair working conditions in a safe, fair workplace. They deserve the protection to exist freely in the economy and have a portion of the economy that they are working to build. They work tirelessly, they work endlessly. And I think we all feel this in the corporate grind of every day. We feel like we work to survive. And people are working to survive while building these companies up, building it so that our global economy and our national economy can be successful. They deserve to have a protected portion of it and a voice in how they're being treated within it. And so I think that's the first and foremost, most important aspect to why, just to boil it down, because they deserve to have a protected voice. We are seeing union busting in no uncertain terms from the federal government to the state government. We're seeing it in the federal government attacking the Veterans Affairs and federal employee unions and saying they can't unionize, the unions are being disbanded. There's no slyness, there's no hidden aspect. It is a clear attack on the right to unionize that is being sold and endorsed by the federal government, the highest voice we have. And as long as that continues, and as long as they push back on the PRO Act, our workers and our working class community will never have the protection they deserve in the workplace.
Absolutely, 100%. And you know, this kind of goes into the next thing is about veteran benefits. And there's something that really caught my eye is prioritizing mental health of veterans. Advocate for expanded mental health resources, suicide prevention programs, and reduce stigma around seeking care for veterans and their families. And also expand disability and specialty care. Fight to reduce barriers for veterans with disabilities, ensuring timely and reliable access to the specialized medical care equipment and support services needed. Very quickly, I want to talk about the suicide rate amongst veterans. In 2022, there were 6,407 veteran suicides in the United States, an average of 17.6 deaths per day. The age-adjusted suicide rate among veterans, 34.7 per 100,000, was approximately double the rate among non-veteran U.S. adults, 17.1 per 100,000. The rate for male veterans was 44% higher than for non-veteran men. The rate for female veterans was 92% higher than for non-veteran women. Female veterans, however, saw a significant 24.1% decrease in their age-adjusted suicide rate from 2021 to 2022. So let's talk about the risk factors of the elevated suicide risk among veterans. What do you think contributes directly into that? And we have the data to back this up, and we'll kind of dive into this a little bit. But, you know, whenever I think of that, I think of like CPTSD, even though it's not recognized by the American Psychological Association, we know damn good well that it does exist. So what are some of those other factors that you know about that contribute to the elevated suicide risk among veterans? And why is it important to recognize on this specific healthcare and this specific aspect? Because I know the direct answer, and let's see if we can agree directly on it. Let's see. We'll do this in real time.
So something I know from, one, being a veteran, having friends who are veterans, having my community in the military, some of the biggest factors I see towards mental health crises, because The problems that are being experienced by veterans are often carried over from active duty service. And it's not like as soon as you get out and you get your DD-214, they issue you mental health illnesses. These are things that are continued over. And a lot of times it's because of the alienation of the military, the continuous told that you're being continuously told that people aren't there, that what you're experiencing is imagined, that you don't have a voice within this gigantic war machine, if you will. You don't have a voice as an individual. You're part of the bigger being, even if you don't morally necessarily agree with it. But a lot of it is stress, it's alienation, it's the style of life. And then you get out and you can't access any of these healthcare things that are supposed to be available to you. Earned benefits is what I would call them, because they are earned. It is a promise that you received when you held up your right hand. You can't access these things anymore. You get out and you're told you're going to have job opportunities, and then people don't have job opportunities. People struggle financially. The military does not pay people very well. It provides a stable income, but 15 to 20% of active duty enlisted personnel receive food assistance. Military members are not by any means rolling in money. And there's a distinct lack of network and lack of support when you get out of the military, that unless you are looking for it very hard, you may not find it, especially in more rural areas. You go back to your community, you go back to being integrated into normal society, into a non-military society, coming from a very tight-knit community, and it's immediately alienating. It's immediately you are in a different kind of realm than you had spent previous years in. You don't have your support group with you. You don't have any of these things. And then when you seek care, you're told you have a 6 to 8 month wait. You're told that you're imagining these things, that they're not real. You have people like Senator Tuberville bringing in experts who are saying that people who seek disability are focused on their issues and not focused on rehabilitation. And we should remove a bunch of disability rating possibilities because of a personal interpretation that it makes people lazy. Seeking medical care because you were injured in the military, or because you're having a mental health crisis because of this lack of support and gigantic alienation, or people who have experienced combat, or even people who haven't, who are in high stress jobs, are coming home and experiencing PTSD incidents, are experiencing long-term debilitating mental struggles, and being told that it's fake and that they're imagining it and they're being dramatic. They're being, by all senses of the word, ignored, with their experiences completely erased, being told, well, just get over it. And I believe that is a giant contributing factor, is not only the alienation, but the fact that every avenue they have to seek support is constantly under attack under every administration. It is constantly under attack, and there's no way to lent it up or release it. And then you have every politician who's running for office, or every politician in office who wants to use them as props, again, removing their identity as an individual and continuing that cycle and saying, I'll fight for veterans benefits, I'll fight for veterans benefits. And then as soon as they get into office, they are part of the attack on veterans benefits, on their earned protections. They're immediately turning the table to, again, not honor that promise, but seek its active betrayal. And so those are some of the gigantic factors in the cycle that I'm seeing firsthand, as well as having lost one of my best friends recently within the past year due to veteran suicide. There are a lot of the issues that I see reflected within our community.
And the next thing that I know is also contributing directly to this is the military sexual assault. And the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, has initiated several changes in the military that critics say reduce protections for some, such as eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion. But one of the other things that he also did was he eliminated a women's committee, which was the committee that advised on issues for women in the military, including sexual assault prevention, has been dissolved by the current Defense Secretary, who stated that it focused on a quote-unquote divisive feminist agenda. So this is also from the same person that has also had his own allegations against him. I you know, we don't have to dive directly into that because there is quite a bit into that. But he also indicated a review of disciplinary rules stating that terms like bullying and hazing have been weaponized against military leaders. What the actual fuck? I can't even begin to tell you how much just even like hearing his voice literally makes me shake. But anyway, thinking about, sexual assault and murder and rape within the military, I can't help but think about a couple different cases that definitely still sticks in my head, and I think about it, and one of them is Vanessa Guillen. Vanessa Guillen was a 20-year-old United States Army soldier. Took place, and the murder of Vanessa took place inside an armory at Fort Hood, Texas, on April 22nd, 2020, when she was bludgeoned to death by another soldier, Aaron David Robinson. And when law enforcement tried to apprehend him in nearby Killeen, Texas, he did fatally shoot himself. I think about this case and I think about how horrific it was and what went into it, and I can't help but continue to ask those questions of why. And those are questions that we will honestly never know the answer to. And Vanessa was 20 years old. She was 20 years old. And how they found her was horrific, and I'll spare those details because I will need to add like 3,000 content warnings and trigger warnings to those because it's very deep. But I know this entire story, and it is deeply devastating. But thinking about that, thinking about sexual assault within the military, what would be part of something that you would champion in regards to military sexual assault and prevention?
So we're definitely seeing an attack on the sexual assault prevention program that we have, frequently called SAPR within military groups. You might hear referred to that because it's just the acronym said together. And you're absolutely right about the fact that there is a giant attack on it, erasing people's entire stories, erasing people's lived experiences. And that's part of what I was referring to when they're experiencing these struggles, they're experiencing these traumatic incidents, because a lot of people only associate combat with a traumatic military experience when sexual assault, rape, sexual harassment, in no uncertain terms, I do not believe anybody can say that is not a traumatic experience. And the military has a very high rate and one of the highest workplace rates of incidents. And the constant, near constant atmosphere of being told that it didn't happen, you deserved it, it didn't. Just get over it. You're dramatic. Any number of things is not shocking to me to find out that is one of the leading cause of veteran and probably active duty suicides as well. I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen it on the ship that I was in. I'm not going to provide any details to make sure that my shipmates' identities are protected, but I've seen the narrative and I've seen the community atmosphere of dismissal and erasure of the incident. And it's disgusting. It's terrible, and you force people into a corner where they are so alienated, so alone, and going through one of the most unimaginably horrible things a human being can experience. I've seen it with men, I've seen it with women, and no matter, it is just as hard to witness, watch, and experience. And strengthening of our sexual assault prevention programs is an absolutely must. We have a gigantic, we have the biggest military budget globally, and we have a gigantic portion of our federal budget going to it. There's no reason why we should continue to try to cut money and funding and structure from these programs, programs that save military service members and veterans' lives, ones that provide one of the most important services. We have a bloated DoD budget. We do. There's a lot of wasted money in it. And to try to cut from one of the most important programs is disheartening and disgusting. There's no other way to put it. We're going to continue to see the catastrophic impacts of the current administration and specifically the Secretary of War, Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth's attack on it, his attack on women in the military, his attack on sexual victims, regardless of gender. We're going to continue to see that until it's rectified. And if I was in the, when I am in office, we are going to fix that. We are going to work every day to make sure that our service members have a voice. It's no longer enough to say, I love our veterans, I love our veterans, and then work against them. We're going to step up, we're going to put in the work, and we're going to get a solidified, protected program to advocate for our veterans. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's no more clear way to say it. We have to champion this. We have to push forward. We have to have protected avenues for our service members and veterans to have a voice, especially when it comes to sexual assault. Because people come home, people get out of the military, and they come home, and they can't deal with the things they experience. They can't mentally handle the fact that for years they were sexually assaulted or sexually harassed, or even if it was just once, that then for years they were ignored. That weighs them down for the rest of their lives. And that's why we're seeing these incredible rates of increased suicide, mental illness, homelessness, because people are not meant to deal with those mental stressors to that extent for so long alone. And it's going to continue until we fix it.
So as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, I know you have been and you understand firsthand about the struggle for equality. I know that you understand it, and the recent wave of anti-LGBTQ rhetoric and legislation, particularly targeting our transgender siblings, is a dangerous attack on our fundamental rights and must be met with unwavering opposition. The Equality Act is something that I think of right off the top of my head, and I know it's on your platform as well. What would the Equality Act do to ensure non-discrimination protections for all LGBTQ plus Americans? Because there's a lot that goes into this. And as a survivor of conversion therapy for 2.5 years, I'm excited to see this on your platform as well, where you state, quote, "This fight also includes banning the dangerous practice of conversion therapy, codifying marriage equality into federal law, and ensuring every member of our community has equal access the gender-affirming healthcare, housing, and opportunities they deserve." Thank you, first of all, for adding this. Not a lot of candidates directly talk about conversion therapy, and I'm living proof that obviously it does not work. I do want to add in here directly that I was not forced into it by my parents. Society told me something was wrong with me, that I needed to change myself, because you're going to be sexually assaulted. You're going to be murdered for being who you are. You're going to be the next Matthew Shepard. These are the things that run through your head constantly, because you see it on social media, you see it on TV, you see it out in the actual world, you see it all the time. But what would the Equality Act look like? And what does full federal equality look like from your perspective?
I love that question. I think the best way to preface the explanation is that, in my opinion, equality and the idea of equality boils down to, regardless of what party you are, understanding the simple fundamental fact that we pride ourselves on our liberties, on being the land of the free, which means inherently every single person has the right to exist and live authentically. And if someone else's authenticity doesn't align with yours, that freedom protects both of your rights to choose your own path of authenticity and how to live your life freely, responsible to you. I think once we understand that perspective from both parties, because we all love our freedom and we all love saying we're the land of the free, and understanding that includes everybody's ability to live authentically and our ability to choose whether or not we participate in certain activities, that is equal protection and that is equality. Not taking away rights or allowing for discrimination based on the fact of an opinion difference. It should be a protected right. And so getting into the Equality Act after that preface, it is a way to prevent that discrimination, because there are people right now in office who think that since my authenticity is different than yours and I don't morally agree with whatever yours is, you should not have the right to do it. Because to me, that's not authenticity and that's not freedom. And it prevents against that discrimination. It provides that whether, regardless of sexual orientation, gender identity, or who you choose to love, identify as, what you prefer to be called, how you feel authentic. It would protect you from discrimination. It provides public accommodation as well to prevent that discrimination. It allows you to access federal programs and not be excluded from them. It essentially makes it so that you can't be discriminated in housing, federal programs, education, medical access to care based on a personal identity, a sexual orientation, or a gender identity. And it's absolutely necessary. The LGBTQ community will always exist. It has always existed. It will continue to exist as an integrated community within the United States. Since the day we were founded to today, we've had an LGBTQ community. Previously, they've been shunted into the shadows and pushed aside. And having grown up in North Carolina in the Bible Belt as an LGBT youth, as an openly bisexual youth, I've seen it. I know what it's like to be in areas and communities that aren't necessarily accepting and that want to pretend you don't exist, and it impacts individuals. When you say someone doesn't exist, you're removing their, not only their identity as a queer person, but their identity as a human. Because the idea of existence erases someone's entire human existence, and providing protections based on that. People think the PRO Act wants to remove equality from people who don't identify as part of the LGBTQ community, but it's because we need those protections to ensure that we are made equal, because people will continuously discriminate on it, deny housing, deny medical care, deny fair education to youth who identify as an LGBT member or college students who do. And it's simply unacceptable. We are the land of the free. That includes the freedom to live authentically and be treated as a human equal.
Mic drop. That's a mic drop moment. Exactly what you just stated is a mic drop moment. And that is the power. First of all, thank you. Thank you for saying exactly what you just stated, because it's absolutely true. Now, the community has made some really good progress. And one of those things, and you know, or one of those aspects of progress is, I think about the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act of 2009, which is a federal law that expands hate crime protections to include crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived sexual orientation, gender identity, gender, disability, race, color, religion, or national origin. It also allows for federal prosecution of hate crimes, providing federal resources and funding to assist in state and local investigations and prosecutions, and establishes penalties up to life imprisonment for certain violent hate crimes. The act was named in honor of Matthew Shepard, a gay college student brutally murdered in 1998, and James Byrd Jr., an African-American man murdered in 1998, as reported by the Department of Justice. So thinking about this, and this was signed on October 28, 2009 by President Barack Obama, and has been implemented, and there have been cases that have been tried under this, but I do not feel that it is expanded in the way in which it needs to be. Because I don't think people are realizing that hate crimes still happen to this day. It's 2025. We're getting ready to wrap up 2025 and move into 2026, and still fighting for the exact same opportunity as everybody else. Something else that I also think about is the gay trans panic defense, or the LGBTQ plus panic defense, which is a legal strategy where a defendant claims that a victim's sexual orientation or gender identity caused them to have a violent reaction, such as murder. There are some states and the District of Columbia, so DC, that have banned the use of the gay and trans panic defense. The number of states with bans changes as new legislation is passed. In many states, this defense is still allowed, though it is controversial and not a freestanding defense. There have been federal legislative efforts to ban the defense in federal courts. So thinking about this, how can we expand upon the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act and also incorporate the gay trans panic defense and remove it from being able to be used?
I think one of, if it's okay, I want to touch on the hate crime aspect. And the, yeah. You said something that I didn't like this statement, but I really liked that you said it this way. You said people don't believe hate crime exists to this day. And we're seeing it not only for on an individual level, but on states introducing bans on pride flags as a pinpointed way to erase identity and stigmatize the community, opening it up further to hate crime. It's legal in most states to fly any sort of racist flag you would like, insert any type of racist organization or hate organization. You can fly their flag protected under your First Amendment right. Yet we're actively attacking and trying to make it illegal to fly pride flags or flags that can be interpreted as representing the LGBTQ community. And I think that when you juxtapose it like that, and the fact that you can fly any sort of flag that you want with any sort of hate symbol, racist symbol on it, yet we're attacking an identity flag to open up the community further on a quiet nature, because that's where they're saying the part, they're not saying that part out loud, but it opens it up further to hate crime because we're saying that is so bad that it should be illegal while we can still fly other racist flags freely under protected speech. But your rainbow flag isn't protected and should be illegal.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I want to pivot here just for a moment because there was something that really caught my attention. And I want to give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of this next topic because it's about gun violence. Gun violence has left a rippling effect on me, and I might get a little emotional here just for a second. But in 2019, one of my best friends, London Taylor, was shot and killed in her home over a joke about her roommate not paying rent. The next person I'm getting ready to mention is the one that called me and told me about London being shot and killed. And her name is Taylor Christine. Taylor and me go back many, many years. Sorry. We go back many years. This is somebody that I grew up with, somebody that showed me that acceptance for being who you are is possible. And knowing that she has seven children and her youngest just started kindergarten without their mother this year in August, and their mother was murdered in cold blood execution style in June of 2024. The debilitating effects that gun violence leaves on communities and families, it literally fucking destroys families. There is a difference between losing somebody to an illness versus them literally being taken at the hands of a senseless act of violence. Whenever I think about that, I think about the school shootings in America alone. America has the highest rate of school shootings. Parents send their children to school, they kiss their loved ones. Oftentimes, for that very last time, because the next time they see their child is in a body bag. That is the reality that we face in this country because we have elected officials that sit on their asses and don't do a goddamn thing. And they sit here and they say, thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers, thoughts and prayers. It is beyond time for policy and action because how many more are we going to allow to be slaughtered in our schools? Whenever I think about this, I think about the police department of Uvalde that stood outside of Robb Elementary School for 77 minutes, listening to the cries, listening to the screams, listening to the gunshots going off inside the school. And they stood there and did not do a single fucking thing. 19 children were killed in Uvalde. Thinking back, thinking about Sandy Hook in 2012, thinking about Parkland in Florida, thinking about Pulse Nightclub, where 49 people who were living authentically and having fun in what they presume to be a safe space are no longer here to celebrate who they are and where we are as a community. Thinking about that, and there's a new documentary that is getting ready to come out, and it is going to be very heartfelt. And Anderson Cooper covered it on 60 Minutes last night. And I want to highlight that because this is a deep, 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 deep minute. And this has literally shape-shifted so many families. And he stated that his interview in 2012 with Jordan Gawi in Aurora, Colorado, forever changed how he covers mass shootings. His name is Gawi, whose sister Jessica was killed in the theater attack, asked journalists to say victims' names, not the shooters. This week, they spoke with Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes and visited the bedrooms of school shooting victims and spoke with the parents. This is what I consider as journalism. I have my own critiques about Anderson Cooper and like corporate media, but I'm really glad that he is using this platform to highlight this directly, because this is something that more journalists need to do. So whenever we think about ethical storytelling, this is exactly how you cover it. You go directly to the people that are closest to the problem because they have the best solutions. So whenever we think about gun violence, I am a supporter of the Second Amendment, but I'm also pro common sense, because common sense is something that our communities lack. 19 of the latest homicides in Kansas City, Missouri alone are domestic violence related, including one very popular teacher in the Kansas City area. So thinking about the issue of gun violence and everything that I have stated, I'm sorry, every time I talk about Taylor, I get very emotional, as a lot of families do and a lot of friends do. Anybody who has had somebody taken out of their life at the hands of violence understands the emotional impact, especially around the holidays. Holidays brings out the best or the worst in people, and whenever there is an empty seat at that table that you're used to seeing, I know that feeling all too well. Both my grandparents are gone, that held the family together. It is very difficult around this time of year, and I want to acknowledge that and let people know, if you are listening, you are not alone. But whenever we think about the epidemic of gun violence and how it tears our communities literally apart, and you're right whenever you state on your website that, quote, the epidemic of gun violence is tearing our communities apart. For too long, the debate has been polarized into a false choice between taking away rights and inaction, with common sense solutions being ignored. This has allowed a public health crisis to fester, leaving our schools, our streets, and our homes vulnerable. First of all, thank you for acknowledging that this is a public health crisis and a public health epidemic that has been far too long pushed to the side. As a Navy veteran, what is your perspective on the shape of gun violence in America?
The shape of gun violence in America is so incredibly inflated due to a lack of substantial policy introduced, any type of gun safety, any type of gun education. We have ignored it and let it fester so much that, exactly what you said, parents fear every day they send their child to school whether or not they will make it home. They fear whether or not their kid going out for the night with their friends in high school is going to come home, is going to make it back, because we've ignored it for so long. We've had time after time after time after again to introduce better policy instead of just saying thoughts and prayers. Because exactly what you just said, our children don't need thoughts and prayers. They need to be included in our policy and regulation so that they can be safe. what we've allowed. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
What we've allowed in this gun epidemic, and by just polarizing the conversation to all or nothing, is to just continue to do nothing, to continue to not take any real action. And to a point, I believe it is on purpose. We see it from both sides to just throw these gigantic polarizing claims at the other side, which allow us then in turn to say, well, we can't get anything done because they only want this, when that's not the case. I would argue the majority of Americans not only want change, but want a common sense and viable solution to achieve it. If a Republican's child gets shot and killed, take the most conservative Republican you can think of, and their child at school gets shot and killed next to their classmate, whose parents are the most left-leaning, most far-left liberal or Democrat or independent you can think of, I guarantee both of those parents will stand side by side and weep for their child who's dead now. It's not a matter of partisan opinion and polarization. Parents want change, our communities want change, and if the politicians in place can't do it because they can't come together and talk and negotiate and problem solve together on something that's affecting every single person in the United States, then they need to get out of office. They're using us and they're using this polarization as an excuse of inactivity. And it's wrong. No one is saying ban every single gun in the United States. And no one is saying issue every child a gun. These are narratives that are falsely produced by politicians in the political agenda and special interest groups to control the narrative to where nothing changes. And it's no, we can't accept it any longer.
Victims, victims, children, and families are not political pawns. This should not be a political issue. And I do want to acknowledge that this is not just a Republican issue, this is not just a Democrat issue. This is literally across the board. These are human beings that are literally losing their lives at an astronomical rate. Going to school, going to church, going to a movie theater, going to college, going to a grocery store. There is a very real chance that somebody can walk outside and be shot just for standing on the sidewalk. It is a very real statistic that people are not addressing because they don't think it's serious enough. But my question is, how many more children, how many more human beings need to be killed before we finally recognize that there is an ongoing issue? How many more? Because enough is enough. And I refuse to stay silent. As a survivor of domestic gun violence, a survivor of sexual assault, a survivor of conversion therapy, I refuse to stay silent. I refuse to bow down to those who want to control me, who want to be in my bedroom and watch every single aspect of what my life looks like. No, I say absolutely not. I refuse to bow down to a corporation or to a billionaire or to a man who steps up to me and says that I am less of a man because I went through X, Y, Z. I absolutely refuse. And I think more men need to recognize that we can be a part of the solution too. I refuse to fall into line with people like Elon Musk and Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump. I refuse to fall into the line of people who say my mom's life does not matter and that those veterans are losers and suckers. I refuse to fall in line with those people who literally turn their backs because somebody comes out as trans or because somebody is reading a book to a child that is dressed in drag. Whenever those children, that may be the only time that they actually have access to seeing somebody who is different outside of what is inside those four walls inside their church, being taught to discriminate, being taught how to hate people, and being taught how to be indoctrinated. But they want to really sit here and state that a drag queen is grooming a child. Let's talk about those clergy members. Let's talk about those pastors. Let's talk about those therapists that are telling a child that, oh, you're gay? Oh, we need to shock the shit out of you so that way we, quote unquote, pray the gay away in you. To quote Laura Bell Bundy, and this is one of the most satire, one of the funniest songs, there is a song that anybody can Google. It's called You Can't Pray the Gay Away. You can find it on YouTube. Laura Bell Bundy, because guess what? You can't pray the gay away. No matter what your preacher says, you cannot pray the gay away. I am the living example that it does not work. It does not work. Statistically, children that are forced into conversion therapy are 4 times more likely to die by suicide than their heterosexual peers. We need our allies, like my mom. We need our allies, like other people that are out there fighting on the front lines. Speaking of that, that goes into the next and the final topic that I wanted to talk to you about. You spent some time in DC this past weekend. Let's walk through what you've seen, what you experienced, what the people that you met, because you were amongst some very incredible people. And I don't know if you got to meet her, but my co-founder, Gwen, was also there and also performed. And she did her song, Barefoot and Pregnant. She also performed Lighter. And she did, oh God, I'm blanking on the other song. It's one of the other, I can't think of it. And I know it. I listen to it all the time in the car going to, okay, anyway. But walk us through what your journey in DC was like this last weekend. You were amongst some incredible people. And let's talk about that and the importance of the power of the people.
Absolutely. This weekend was truly incredible. It was a surreal moment. And I even talked about it online of the fact that a few months ago, I filed to run for Congress because I believed that a better way was possible. And we can all see that the politics in place, the system in place, is allowing the working class communities like ours to be continuously left behind, to be continuously betrayed, to allow the LGBT, the veterans, the children, the senior citizens to be continuously shunted to the side. And a few months ago when I filed, simply believing there was a better way, I would never have believed that in a few months, 5 months later, I would have had the opportunity to stand alongside such progressive champions that were in DC, united by that same belief that there would be estimated from the organization, it's estimated between 14 to 20,000 people were there. And that many people showed up from their normal lives, paid money to travel, took time off of work, which we know in this economy is nearly impossible to do comfortably, to show up and make their voices heard. And it was an incredibly, incredibly surreal experience. From the veterans rally on Friday, which I had the opportunity to speak at, to Saturday, where tens of thousands of people marched down the streets of DC and we got to lead from the front. It was incredible. It was such a moving experience. And anyone in politics and anyone fighting the good fight, as you know, I'm sure firsthand, it can be alienating and it can be a grind and it can wear you down mentally. And getting to experience that energy and getting to recharge with thousands of people from every corner of the United States who, regardless of background, know there's a better way and know there is hope for our democracy and we can protect it, honestly rejuvenated me. It completely recharged my battery, inspired me, and gave me new ways to consider going about this continued effort and continued fight that we have going on in Central Florida. And hearing people's stories was honestly life-changing. I know that can sound a little dramatic, but I think it is the most apt term to describe this weekend was life-changing. It completely just blew me away to get to stand alongside so many people and hear so many voices united in one single call for change. I think it's the definition of coalition, and it was magical.
And it's the power of the people is what is going to save us. The mainstream and the corporate media is not going to save us because they're complicit in the silence. What is going to save us is communities rising up and fighting back. And with that, is there anything else you wanted to talk about or highlight or what's next for you in your campaign? Or how can also people contribute to your campaign? And how can people also follow you on social media and just give us those wrapping thoughts?
Absolutely. Thank you. I would say for a final message, we just have to remember that growing up, we all heard about the American dream. We were taught that it's inherent to our identity as Americans, and it's the possibility of our nation and the highest promise for liberty and justice for all, and that we'd all have the opportunity to have the American dream, and there's nothing we couldn't do, and there's nothing we can't do still in order to maintain that, because we're seeing attacks on our equality, we're seeing attacks on our ability to succeed, we're seeing attacks on the programs that allow quote-unquote people to pull themselves up from the bootstraps, and we're seeing an attack on the ability to for an average individual to attain the American dream. We have to protect it. No one's coming to save us. It's up to us. This attack is in our neighborhoods. It's in our grocery stores. It's in our health insurance. It's in our childcare and our lack of health insurance. No one is coming. We have to do it. Every single person listening, every single person that's going to watch this on social media or wherever you get your podcasts, it is up to you. It's up to all of us. We have to protect the American dream. We have to protect the promise of liberty and justice for all, because it can easily be destroyed and hurt by people who want to circumvent our protected liberties or even destroy them. It's up to us. We have to do it. The time is now. The fight will be continued, and it is a marathon, not a sprint. If you're interested in getting involved and joining the fight, I proudly do not take any corporate special interest money, any foreign interest money, none of it. I'm proudly grassroots, supported only from our communities here, and it's kindredforcongress.com. Any amount really adds up, especially when you're taking on a behemoth of corruption, when you're taking on the special interest groups and the foreign interest groups. We have merch. You can also get involved, donate, volunteer, get involved, anything. Sharing 100% free. Share it on any platforms, Facebook, Instagram, social media. The same with the Rise Above Justice movement. Share all of their stuff. It is completely free. Right now, it's very hard for a lot of people to donate. Sharing is free. In advertisement, your voice is your strongest tool, and it's the most authentic. So please share, please get involved however you can. I'm on all social media as Maria Elena Kinter, and thank you again for inviting me on this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and you take care of yourself, my friend, okay?
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.